This episode of the Tech Central podcast is brought to you by Pinnacle, Africa's top ICT distribution business, delivering the exceptional every time. I'm Duncan McLeod, and you're listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm in four ways in Johannesburg today to talk to Sevir Ramdani, Chief Development Officer at CECOM, for a discussion about the past, present, and future of the telecommunications provider. Sevir is responsible for developing new markets for CECOM's wholesale telecoms offerings, identifying new growth projects and commercial opportunities, overseeing strategic planning, and supporting the M&A strategy. Sevir, welcome to the podcast. I was thinking just the other day that CECOM has been around for quite a long time now. I remember traveling with the founder, Brian Herlihy, to visit the landing station, which was still under construction at the time, in Maputo in Mozambique. That must have been around, I think, 2008, 2009, somewhere around there. A lot has changed since then in Africa's telecoms market, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you, firstly, for the opportunity to catch up with you. So much has changed in the market. You know, back then when we looked at the continent, it was, much of the story about underpenetration and access to the internet. In 2007, it was just a completely different era. Almost a Jurassic period, because we spoke then about satellite being the only means of communications, and we came along with fiber, and we were, you know, these rocket scientists on the block. And much has changed. Much has changed. Now you've got fiber to your home. Internet penetration across the continent's looking a lot better. But one would dispute whether it's internet penetration we need or broadband penetration, you know. But at the same time, pricing's come a long way. And that puts a lot of commercial pressure on operators. And I think that's the state we find ourselves in today. It's trying to monetize our assets adequately.
Well, when CECOM arrived on the scene, there was effectively a monopoly provider of undersea infrastructure into South Africa. There was the SAT-3 cable on the West Coast, and I think the SAT-2 cable was still in service then, but that was about it, really. You guys brought the first subsea competition to the African market.
Yeah, absolutely, we did. And it was a profound opportunity for the market as well as for ourselves. Often people say that great opportunities are created from great problems.
Yeah.
And that was exactly it. It was completely a monopoly. There were so many things wrong in the market, not just the lack of supply, but lack of the appropriate commercial model. So, Duncan, you'll recall that there's a couple of ways that these undersea cable systems are built, in commercial models, that is. In consortium, where telecoms operators get together and they share the cost of building the infrastructure. In return for taking that risk, typically the old-school consortiums that allow only one provider to land and operate a cable per country. So typically the SAT-3 cable, as an example, would connect South Africa to Namibia, go up to Angola and so forth, all the way up to London. And each country would share the cost of construction, but one person per country would control the landing rights. And I think SAT-3, very typical of its time and era and the thinking of the industry at the time, it actually had a lot of capacity. So supply wasn't the problem. It was the commercial basis upon which that supply was made available into the market that was so prohibitive. And you'll remember back then we spoke about the cost of connecting Joburg to Cape Town was the same as connecting Joburg to London.
And that's changed completely.
And that's changed completely,
I remember when CECOM launched, many ISPs here in South Africa used it to launch uncapped ADSL. I think MWeb led the charge back then. And they were using CECOM's cheaper bandwidth to do that. It just wasn't possible before because of the high cost of international bandwidth. And I remember at one stage that some ISPs became entirely reliant on CECOM. And if there was an outage on the system, and there were outages on the system, thanks to ship's anchors, I think, users would be entirely offline, no international bandwidth. But that's changed with new undersea cables that have come in. New systems are coming online all the time. There's now new transatlantic routes that are being planned. Looking at all the developments in the subsea market since CECOM arrived on the scene about 10 years ago, do you think the market is getting a bit overheated, a bit overtraded in your view, or is what we're seeing in the space purely a response to anticipated market demand?
So overheated, overtraded, possibly. But I think if you, I was doing some research last night, in fact, and if you look at the amount of underpenetration across the continent, especially from a broadband perspective, so people may have access to the internet, but they're still using Edge in some cases, and 3G. And you know, I was on holiday on the coast, and as soon as my phone switches to 3G, the frustrating experience comes back.
You know? They call it Edge for a reason, because it puts you on edge.
Absolutely. So I think if I took a really big step back, I would have to acknowledge that there's probably room for many more cables to come onto the continent. However, they'll be operated in a very different commercial basis. So Seacom was born out of a very unique opportunity. The monopoly that was created actually created a commercial basis for us to build and own and operate a private system into South Africa. Nowhere else in the world has a private cable system been as successful as Seacom has been on the east coast of Africa. And that's because once the supply comes in, fiber economics kick in. Effectively, to put on, light up another wave costs you virtually nothing, and market prices collapse. Now, therefore, it makes it commercially very difficult to justify subsequent cables. However, it doesn't mean that new cables will not be built. Personally, I think that the cable across the Atlantic is not commercially viable. It's my personal opinion. I think it's been driven by egos and government money. And that's the reason, and it will justify building a cable in someone else's mind. Whether they'll get their money back, I personally doubt it. Other cable systems being built across the continent, as well as the globe at this point in time. If you look at the number of cables built by the OTTs over the last 5 years, they add up to something like 15 or 18 cables funded by Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft. So 20 years ago, cable bills were being pushed by Vodafone, you know, the AT&Ts and so forth. 20 years ahead, they're all going to be pushed by the OTT players. So there will be new cables, but just for very different commercial reasons.
It's interesting you say the OTTs are building these systems. Now, I presume the traditional telcos are also still continuing to put this infrastructure into the ocean. But with companies like Google and Facebook investing in subsea infrastructure, how does that change the model and the ecosystem?
Well, it does. It does substantially. And I think, you know, your first question there is, do the big operators continue to invest? I think they do, but their business cases are becoming marginal. Mm-hmm. And they're in a transitional era at this point in time. I think they're losing their stronghold and their on the submarine industry. Those big traditional telco operators are still building submarine cable systems. They're building it because they have a department of 100 people that, if they don't build a cable, will be out of a job, right? But the commercial basis for them are becoming incredibly difficult. And the reason for that is the second part of your question, is when the OTTs build a cable system, they bring the content of the planet to the destination point of that cable system. So the need for an established operator or for an ISP to go off continent becomes a lot less. So they're actually just picking up maybe in the reverse. You'll remember in 2007 when we did this math and we've presented this to you, we would have said 90% of traffic flowed off the continent. Today, probably only 40% of continent flows off the continent. Of content flows off the continent. It's a very big switch. In the future, it'll probably be something like 10% that goes off the continent.
Is that because these big OTT providers are putting infrastructure?
Content, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So content's moving to the African soil.
Interesting. So what does that mean for the business model for subsea cables if the big content providers are putting down CDNs, content distribution servers, in places like Teraco? Does it mean there's less demand for subsea systems?
Yes, it does mean that there's less demand for dedicated off-continent traffic. But the model's fundamentally different. When you, as a private entity, like an enterprise, could get a 10 gig wavelength or 100 gig wavelength to Ireland for your private network, and if it's affordable enough, it's $1,000 a month, chances are you probably will do it. And that's where the market shifts to. So I did some maths last night as well. If you looked at 100% growth of bandwidth over 5 years, you would grow 10 gigs of demand to 1,000, you know. So if you look at transatlantic and transpacific demand, it's growing at such a rapid rate because it's so cost effective. It doesn't mean that the capacity is being utilized efficiently. Someone may just buy a wavelength because they can, you know, and make use of it in a very unique and private manner. It may not be a terabit the way or several terabit the way that Google needs, but it does introduce different business concepts, and private businesses out there will embrace those opportunities. Yeah,
it's interesting though, the, you know, with companies like Netflix and the big content providers putting up infrastructure here in South Africa. Do you see CECOM perhaps becoming more of a conduit or less of a conduit for traffic from Europe and North America into South Africa, and perhaps more of a conduit for traffic from these content distribution networks which are being established in South Africa into other regions in Africa?
Yes, we're a business, so we'll take all opportunity. And it comes in its waves. So I think our first wave, maybe going back a few years here, was helping the operators go out with. So it was outbound, trying to get content offshore. But over the last couple of years, we've been helping a lot of the OTTs come onto the continent. And what we were, I think, was an interim step and will remain to be somewhat of an interim step, helping them justify that Africa is worth investing in. Mm. And I think we've now reached the point where there is a lot of interest in Africa, but Africa's not one place. So South Africa is incredibly attractive. Following that, of course, Nigeria, and following that is Kenya. But is there really interest in Mozambique, Tanzania, Kenya, Rwanda, Botswana? Not yet. So I think we will begin to start serving, helping those people, helping the OTT serve those smaller markets.
Yeah.
Ultimately, though, when a market becomes big enough and substantial enough, those guys will build and come here. And we've seen them do that in Brazil, we've seen them do that to Australia, we've seen them doing a transatlantic as well as trans-Pacific.
Yeah. So let's talk about, I'm sure there'll be some people listening to this podcast who don't have a clear picture of what the CECOM subsea system looks like.
Sure.
It runs from Mthunzini on the KwaZulu-Natal coast, and then it connects obviously into terrestrial fiber networks here in South Africa. It then runs up the east coast with landing stations in various countries. I think in Mozambique, Tanzania, yeah. Kenya.
Correct.
Am I missing any?
It then runs up to Djibouti.
Djibouti.
It also runs to India.
So there's a spur to India.
There's a spur to India. And then it runs up to Egypt, traverses Egypt, traverses the Mediterranean, lands in France, and then traverses France into London.
Into London on a terrestrial cable.
Yeah, that's okay. Right.
And I've always been interested about that India leg that CECOM built. How much traffic does that carry?
Not as much as we'd like, to be honest with you. So there is increasing interest, but fundamentally, though, most traffic flows move up to France and London. Hmm. And the reason for that is the pricing arbitrage. The pricing in India, as an example, if you want to connect to the internet or get access to Indian content, is still substantially high. To give you kind of some of the relative pricing, it's about $10 to $15 a megabit in India versus 50 cents a megabit in France or London.
Wow.
So you can see that African operators still just prefer to go up to Europe.
That's interesting. Yeah. But when there's a fault in the system, and I know that one or two ships' anchors have been dropped through your cable over the years, do you reroute traffic through India?
Yeah, we used to do that, and less so now.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is when the WAX cable system came along and was upgraded, there was a substantial amount of diverse, cost-effective capacity on the West Route.
Uh-huh.
So we prefer to manage that routing via the West Coast where we can. So we do route some diversity to India, but most of it runs off the West Coast at this point in time.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay. Now, I don't know if you have these figures to hand, but are you able to maybe give us some insight into how the amount of traffic being carried on the CECOM system has increased over the years?
Yeah. So in 2007, all of South Africa's international bandwidth added up to 11 gigs. When we went live in 2009...
11 gigabits a second.
11 gigabits a second, yeah. So when we went live in 2009, we bumped that up to 40 gigs. And today, I think we're probably running on about 600 or 700 gigabits.
On CECOM?
On CECOM alone.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it must be well into the terabits then for the whole country.
For the whole country, I'd estimate it. We haven't updated this research recently, but we used to collaborate with Telegeography to do this, but I would easily estimate it over a terabit. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've really come a long way as a country.
Yeah. Amazing. So CECOM's been around for 10 years. How much useful life does it have left in it? I know these systems do have a limited lifespan. I suppose the fish eventually chew through the plastic sheathing around the cable. How much longer is CECOM going to be around for?
So, you know, there's always a commercial basis to extract as much value as you can. So typically the cable system will survive up to 25, potentially even 30 years. The question is, will you need it?
Yeah.
When more cable systems come along, designed differently, and if there's adequate diversity, you probably would not want to keep up the maintenance on an older cable system.
It becomes more expensive.
Yeah. Well, not that it's more expensive. It's just that it is a maintenance cost. So if you've got four routes, and let's imagine in 10 years' time, there may be four routes or five routes out of South Africa, would you want to maintain a sixth or a seventh route? You probably wouldn't, you know, because the way that maintenance works, Duncan, is that you pay per kilometer. So whether you're using the cable system or not, you need to have a ship up there, and you're going to pay your portion of the maintenance per kilometer.
All the time. The ship
all
has
the
to
time. Yeah, exactly. Mm. So those are the reasons why cable systems are shut down. Not that they're not functioning. It's just that commercially, you would look at the operating cost and you'd say, well, I've got enough diversity. I don't really want to pay that operating cost. You know, that's, so that's where typically things should shift to. The other thing that tends to influence cable lifespans is the technical design of the cable system and upgradability. So typically what happens is you have the quality of fiber that's deployed, the number of fiber pairs that's deployed, as well as repeaters. Depending on the technical type of repeater that you use and the distance that you allocate, all of these factors sum up to the design capacity. And effectively, once you've made that first investment, that design capacity gets limited only for one variable. That variable is the quality of the optical modems on the end. So if those optical modems get better, that's great. You get more capacity to the system. But you can't fundamentally change the quality of the infrastructure that you put in. The only thing you can work on is the modems. So to give you a sense, when we put in the CECOM system, with the best all elements put together, the best you could ever get out is 1.2 terabits. Today, you could easily get 12 terabits. And literally, in a matter of 12 to 18 months, the quality of these systems, they call it coherent DWDM technology that's going in, submarine capacity that's going in, as well as expanding the optical bands in use, they're speaking about 30 terabits.
On the CECOM system?
No, on a new cable system.
I see, okay. Yeah.
So we've upgraded our system, and we've got a capability of up to 6 terabits at this point in time.
But that may improve in future as the technology improves.
It may improve. It may improve, yeah.
So you spoke about DWDM. That stands for Dense Wave Division Multiplexing.
Yeah.
Just explain what exactly that is. It's a way of compressing light over the cable system and more efficiently carrying data across a piece of fiber.
So typically when people think about light, they think of white light. So if you had to flash a torch across a room and use Morse code, effectively you're using light to communicate. So when you get into an optical system as well, people once again keep that simple thinking of switching a light on and off through an optical system. But think of a radio. You know, you've got 94.7, you've got 5 FM on 98 kilohertz, you know, those sorts of things. So you still have the radio spectrum, you're selecting a specific frequency, and you're all communicating at the same time. So on light, it's exactly the same. White is actually a blend of all the colors of the rainbow. And all you've got to do is, through the optical fiber, simultaneously flash a green light as well as a red light, and you've broken down your communication to multiple channels. And that's what it is. So DWDM takes it up to 128 channels.
Right. And they're different. I hear talk of 40G, 100G.
Yeah.
Some people are talking 400G. This is just simply the capacity.
The modulation.
So the capacity of these modems that are sitting on each end to transfer more data.
Yeah. So once you've got the one fiber optic pair, and you've now decided to flash through different colors of light, the question is, how fast can you switch on and off that light? And that's where the modulation comes in. And so today, 100 gig is pretty much standard. If you were building any system, you wouldn't build less than 100 gig. But there's already developments in place where you can like 400 gigs on a wavelength. You know, and people have already trialed a terabit on a wavelength.
Wow.
So it's leaps ahead.
Yeah. But you can't just upgrade to these technologies. I presume the faster the system, the more expensive it is to upgrade your subsea network.
No, actually, you could just change the cards in the end. However, there's something called Shannon's Law, which says the amount of capacity of data that can be transmitted, there's a relationship between the signal-to-noise ratio. So when you're switching on these lights all at once, you're actually causing a degree of interference with each other.
Interesting.
And it creates a signal-to-noise ratio. The signal is what you want, and the noise is what you don't want. And once you've deployed that infrastructure in the ocean 10 years ago, you can't go back and redesign your signal-to-noise ratio.
Understood.
You know, so there's a limit to how much you can upgrade the system, which is why if we talk about a new system being designed to tolerate 30 terabits of data, you can't do that necessarily in an old system.
I see.
you're designing from scratch, you can get the 30 terabits.
Yeah.
But if you're upgrading, you're probably going to end up at, you know, 6 or 7.
So how does Seacom decide when to do an upgrade? Is it purely based on demand?
No, purely economics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got cash flows to manage as well as a demand forecast. Typically, we try to upgrade, you know, once in 2 years because it helps well with our capex planning cycles. What's unique about Seacom, though, is that if a big opportunity came along next week, we could push an upgrade through within 3 months. If there was a business case to justify it, we don't need to sit in a committee and make a decision. You know, our CTO makes the call based on a business case, and we go out and upgrade the system. It's really a matter of ordering cards and ensuring that you configure the system to tolerate those cards between South Africa and London. And that's it. It's done.
And at each segment of the cable, you've got to put cards in.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So the cable is broken into segments like you described. And so it's actually, people don't realize that there's actually electronics on the submarine system as it runs into alongside the continent. So every 100 kilometers, you have an optical amplifier that's powered on the fleet, on the seabed. When it's first built, it's probably the size of a 27 kilogram gas cylinder, if you can keep that in mind. So it's pretty big. And when it drops 5 kilometers deep into the ocean, naturally pressure compresses the cylinder into probably the size of a 9 kilogram cylinder. So that's a massive compression on steel, right?
That's incredible.
Yeah, but inside it's this tiny piece of electronic. And what that electronic amplifier does is it boosts the optical signal without actually intervening and stopping the signal. So it's quite a curious and interesting way in which it just powers up the photons within the optic fiber. But not once. The problem, though, is you've got to get electricity to the...
I was about to ask, does that have to be powered? And where do you get the power from?
It is actually powered.
Yeah.
And so you therefore break the cable into segments, and you have to run 10,000 volts pretty much across each segment. So if you... This is not going to help with the podcast, but you can actually get a sense here.
Sylvia is just showing me a cutaway, I presume, of the Seacom cable.
Maybe we can upload some pictures when you...
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll see that you run 10,000 volts on the copper in the center of the cable between these segments.
This copper here?
Yeah.
All right. So there's a thin bit of copper housing the fiber optics. And then around that is a big thick section of plastic, perhaps 3 millimeters thick. And then this...
steel.
More steel on the outside for reinforcement. And then a further sheath of... hardened plastic or something on the outside.
Yeah, that's right. So if you had to go into the seabed, it's 5 kilometers deep, so we're proper out in the, you know, into the past the continental shelf, proper depths of the ocean, you'd actually only see the white plastic. The steel sheeting around it's only installed on the sections that come up the continental shelf where people potentially fish or drop an anchor, you know, those sorts of things. But the 10,000 volts that I was referring to runs... every 100 kilometers powers up the electronics. It earths to the ocean, so that's how the current flows. And then it lands about, you know, 2,000 to 4,000 kilometers later. And then you repower the system every 2,000 to 4,000 kilometers. You know, so that's effectively why you end up with these segments.
Fascinating. Fascinating stuff. So I mentioned Brian Herlihy a bit earlier in the discussion. He stepped away from an active involvement in the business. Byron Clatterbuck is now CEO. But does Brian Herlihy remain a shareholder in the business? And what is his involvement in the business today?
Yes, Brian has remained our visionary and will forever remain our visionary. He's also a shareholder, still is. He sits on our board of directors, and he chairs our strategy and investment subcommittee of the board. So he's still very actively guiding the direction of the company.
Okay. I know he's very a big picture guy, and he's been involved in some other big infrastructure projects since leaving his active involvement in Seacom.
Yeah, Brian's core competence, I'd prefer for him to speak to
it,
but his core competence is really around project finance and strategy.
Yeah.
And he was born out of the power sector as well as the telecom sector. So he's always had these two industries very close to his heart. So he's been involved with a number of power projects across the African continent. And I think what's very unique about Brian, in addition to his visionary ability to identify large-scale infrastructure opportunities and his ability to sell that, is that he's passionate about Africa. And, you know, he's been living in Johannesburg for the last 5 years or so, relocated his wife and kids to to Johannesburg and is running a number of projects out of South Africa.
Oh, it's good to hear. Yeah. It's good to hear. Okay, so let's talk about the Seacom timeline. A lot has happened since the launch of the subsea cable. You're much more than just a subsea cable operator now. There's obviously been the launch of Seacom Business here in South Africa. I'm not sure if you've launched that in other African markets.
In Kenya as well.
In Kenya as well, okay. Which we can obviously talk about that in a little bit more detail. But maybe take us through some of the timeline of events since 2009.
Yeah, I'll perhaps keep it broad if you don't mind.
Of course.
The first challenge, like you rightfully pointed out, was the cable system in 2007 and keeping it up. Unfortunately, it's very interesting if you're reflecting back. Do you remember there was a problem across Egypt?
Yes.
Right. So,
and that's
It was a regulatory issue around the Arab Spring. So a big part of those early problems was the fact that we couldn't complete construction across Egypt. And, it's not well known in the market, but that took us 3 years to resolve post the Arab Spring.
Good grief.
So, 3 years to resolve, only being resolved post the Arab Spring.
So how were you connecting through Egypt at that
time? So we would land in India and tap onto a CMEV 4 cable.
From India?
Oh. From India and then run up into Europe.
Good grief.
So those were the challenges that we faced. And the most interesting one is, remember, we made it to Zapiro because we had the Somali pirates attack us whilst we're building the cable system as well, right?
So we got a Zapiro.
Yeah, how cool is that? We got a Zapiro cartoon, and we're not a political party, and so we had to get past those kind of construction challenges. Then diversity, like you pointed out. So that's when we made the substantial investments in the WAX cable system. We also acquired some capacity in the Teams cable system in East Africa. So it was really about diversifying our infrastructure. In parallel with those efforts, it was connecting more and more cities. So you'll recall that we were a key anchor tenant on DFA's build between Joburg and Durban.
Yes.
And similarly, we connected up from Mombasa to Nairobi, Nairobi to Kampala, and last year Kampala to Kigali as well. So we've been on this journey of trying to connect as many cities as possible. Like Byron, our CEO, always says, you've built the pipe, fill the pipe. That kind of thinking. But having said that, we were the first to recognize that the status quo just wouldn't remain. We couldn't continue just running a traditional transmission business. And in 2010 already, we built our first IP network. We've since upgraded the IP network, but the concept of an IP network was to move away from the infrastructure into layer 3, an internet-grade service. And this is where we did dynamic routing. And for the first time, we enabled cities to connect directly. Because in spite of all the infrastructure, because of the cost arbitrage, it was cheaper for companies or businesses and ISPs to go to London, Tanzanian ISP to go to London and connect with a Kenyan ISP in London than run from Tanzania to Kenya, because they felt there was not enough justification to dedicate a circuit to their own neighbor. And we felt it was ludicrous, of course, and the quality of the internet was suffering for that matter. So when we launched IP services, we allowed every country to connect to every other country directly in a low latency perspective. We also started bringing in caches. We use our own generic caches because at that point in time, like 2010, really, the OTTs were not particularly interested in Africa. So we had to use generic caches to bring content onto this African soil and then introduce a low latency experience. When that success of layer 3 and the internet was proven, OTTs then began to get an interest. The first people that ventured onto the continent were the CDN operators. So this is the likes of an Akamai, CDN networks, and so forth. When the CDNs started coming on, then the OTTs began to watch the CDNs get onto the content. And of course, the OTTs pay these CDN networks, right? So the OTTs just decided to just skip that and come in directly. So then the likes of the Googles came along, Facebooks, Microsoft, and so forth. So that's been happening, I'd say, sort of 2015, 2016, 2017, the presence of the OTTs. So having moved into layer 3 wholesale and having diversified our cable system and having access to so many markets, with price decline, which frankly we enable and we created this massive price decline, we saw the opportunity, after having respected our key anchor tenants' clauses and giving them enough time to make their businesses robust, an opportunity to step forward in the value chain. And that's when we invested in Seacom Business. And this was about 2015. So whilst the wholesale industry was rapidly transforming and so much was taking place on the African continent, we took a step forward into the business space, primarily because a barrier to entry had been taken away. You'll recall back then, the only way to connect to a last mile user was to go through Telkom or Neotel. And Neotel was in a very bad way back then. But when DFA and came along with their Conduct investment, they then enabled last mile fiber available on a very affordable basis. We saw no reason to make use of their fiber to provide services into the market. And then I think we introduced a really next wave of growth in CECOM story, which once again further beneficiated the industry. So wholesale prices, and I think this is a very important point, 2009, when we went live to 2015, or short of end of 2014, wholesale prices collapsed significantly. And whilst there was downstream pricing benefits, like you pointed out, the ADSL uncapped bundles and so forth being offered to market, but was the market really being uplifted? And was the business segment really benefiting from this? At the end of 2014, 100 meg into an office environment would cost you 100,000 rand a month, right? Duncan, today, 100 meg into your office would cost you 8,000 rand a month, right? So that's almost one-tenth, more than one-tenth the pricing point. That only happened because CECOM, on the back of DFA, launched the enterprise business. So people hate us. I get it.
Yeah. You know, I was about to say, when you launched this, you really did rub up some ISPs the wrong way, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. But I'd like to think that we encourage them to be more efficient.
Yeah.
So.
Have they forgiven you?
Well, for the most part, yes. But you know, when there's high margins in an industry, it attracts competition.
Yeah.
Right. And so at 8,000 rand a month, there's a number of ISPs out there that are still making good margin. Mm. It's also forced them to invest in being more efficient, though. You know, I think that's what creates a healthy and sustainable industry. The most important point when we just consider this is, what is the cost of 100 meg in New York or Hong Kong, for that matter, or London? It's 3,000 rand. Mm. Okay, so at some point, we're all going to have to be that efficient.
Right? So prices still have somewhere to go down in your view.
Yeah. We'd like to think that volumes need to pick up as well. Yeah.
Okay. So, Sevier, you're Chief Development Officer at CECOM. What does that role entail exactly?
A couple of things. It involves the responsibility for the strategy of the company. And I think I'm uniquely positioned because of my history being part of the founding team to help guide that strategy. Strategy has two roles. It involves helping the executive team with defining it and executing it. But a big part of it is also selling it to the shareholders and ensuring that the shareholders are on this journey with us. Going back about 2 years, we decided to, and we saw the challenges within the industry, we saw the opportunity to consolidate the market. So we've been on an acquisition trail for the last 2 years. We're now into a fourth acquisition, two of which were announced perhaps in about 8 weeks' time. So we
will be announced.
Will be announced, okay, in 8 weeks' time. We're cautious of announcing them at this point in time. We've done two which we've announced, and we've got two more to announce in about 8 weeks' time. And the next one is going to be far more sizable and national in nature.
Interesting.
So it's going to be really a good, interesting play for the market. My second part of my responsibility is the acquisitions, the acquisition strategy, as well as the execution thereof. Of course, I support the CFO in fundraising. And because of my history, I also support the commercial teams with opening up new markets. Having said that, last year we opened up Rwanda and Botswana. I think we continue to look at new markets, but it is becoming increasingly difficult. As you get into smaller and smaller landlocked nations, it becomes quite difficult to get into those markets.
Without giving away the game, you've mentioned two acquisitions are coming up. Yeah. Where do you need to make acquisitions? What type of companies are you looking for exactly?
So there's two parts to the equation, the profit equation. It's about getting margin, which is revenue less your costs, on one side. The other one's volume. So we really need to grow the customer base. And not just in terms of signed customers, but potentially addressable customers. If you have a base of addressable customers, your sales team have something to sell to. So where we've focused on is acquisition of last mile into enterprise markets, as well as enterprise customers. So you'd see, similar to our acquisition in Cape Town of Macroland, we wanted to set up a Western Cape presence. Macroland helped us do that. It's no-brainer that we'd like to do that. It would make sense that we would like to do that in places like Durban, you know, potentially other tier two cities. So that's really the theme of our acquisition strategy.
Mm. But it's business. You won't entertain consumer-focusing acquisition.
It's all business,
Okay. What about data centers? I know some subsea operators have gone into building data centers at their landing stations, for example, and building cloud offerings around those. Is that something that Seacom has considered? Is it something you might do in the future?
Yeah, it is something that we've considered. We've studied it quite well, mm-hmm. and I think we understand it well enough not to get into it. And the reason for that is Turk is a great example of a phenomenal success story, a success story that we supported, and in fact, we helped sell in the market as well. We're big proponents of Turk, and we remain to this day. A data center needs to be open access and independently owned. I think as soon as Seacom takes a shareholding in a data center, it'd probably do a disservice to the data center. Having said that, data center is a great investment opportunity. We've encouraged our shareholders to invest into these kinds of facilities. Having said that, there's certain ripe market conditions in which a data center business would flourish. South Africa matured post the 2008 Eltec court case in which, you know, there were suddenly 200 licensees. When you have 200 licensees in an open market, that warrants the data center. You know, similarly in Nigeria, there's a number of operators, not as aggressive as they are in South Africa, but a number of operators, and you've seen some data centers begin to flourish. It's been a bit more of a challenge in Nigeria. Kenya's ripe, and there's been some smaller investments. But if you look at the size of the Kenyan market, it's 1/10, if that, of the South African market. So, yeah, and then now when you start filtering past Kenya, market opportunities begin to drive very quickly, you know.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Before I let you go, and I know this is a difficult question, with 10 years of Seacom, market has changed quite fundamentally in that time. Look into your crystal ball. Tell us what it'll look like 10 years from now. 5 years, if 10 years is too far into the future.
No, I love these kinds of questions because it forces me to actually do my job. just think ahead. Look, I think you got to look. The answer comes from the industry. And when people ask me strategy questions, I always think of the Philip Kotler saying that the future is not ahead of you. In fact, it's already around you, unevenly distributed between peoples, nations, and businesses, right? So let's think about where telecoms and the internet space has ended up in the US, in Asia, in Europe. And when one gives enough reflection upon that, Seacom's future and South Africa's industry, where we will end up, is pretty obvious too. So prices will fall down, and that's the one thing we do know. So how does one maintain margin in an environment where prices fall this dramatically? It's densification. You've got to consolidate South Africa's assets, have enough users densely populating your asset to ensure that margins are suitable at a lower price. So into the future, I think Seacom will continue to be part of Seacom business. I think it may also, in a search for densification and utilization of assets, probably move into the consumer space even, right? Only because it's about filling the pipes. And Seacom itself either will be a huge group or part of a huge group.
Great. Well, this has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. Thank you, Sevier. Sevier Ramdhani is Chief Development Officer at Seacom.
Thank you.